Kids tuned to yesterday, bringing you programs from radio's golden years. I'm your host, Mark Livonier, in this hour, science fiction, later on, from Lights Out from 1939. But first, an episode of X-1 called Point of Departure, an NBC broadcast from October 17th, 1957.
Countdown for blast-off. X-minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X-minus 1, fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future. Adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company presents
X-1.
Point of Departure by Vaughn Shelton. But first, hear this.
Hi there, this is Tennessee Ernie Ford. Say, let me put a question to you. How much do you appreciate the things that make life just a little easier? Like living any place you've a mind to. Now, according to our Constitution, if we don't like where we live, we can move to any other state we want to. All we have to do is hop in our car or take a train or a plane, and off we go. And when we get where we're going, there's plenty of stores and shops and tradesmen to help us in our new home. But let's go back a spell to 1790 and see what happened then when folks got the urge to move. If you were living back then, you'd maybe pick up a copy of the Providence Gazette, and you read an article called Advice to American Farmers. It tells all about moving out west, which is western Pennsylvania and Ohio in 1790. It says if you're moving, you'd better take along some apple, peach, and garden seeds, a kettle for boiling, maple sap, and of course a gun and plenty of ammunition. You should also have a Bible. Other folks moving west in 1790 took along maple saplings to plant, or homemade tools they could use to build boats when they got there. Boats were about as important as horses in 1790. Most of the towns were built inside a fort, since the Indians didn't specially like all this pioneering that was going on, and guns and ammunition were worked overtime. And Indians weren't the only ones who gave folks trouble. There was plenty of bear and wolves and other wild animals to keep folks on their toes. But somehow, in spite of all the fuss and bother of moving into a new community, folks in 1790 didn't complain. They just kept working and fighting, so living would be easier in the future. The future you're now protecting.
Now, X-1 and Point of Departure by Vaughn Shelton.
Before I make this statement, I am well aware that you, gentlemen, are the board of directors and not likely to believe me. The overwhelming concrete fact that we face is that the Utah Flats atomic plant is short $300,000. You've asked for an explanation before the district attorney's office is called. I shall explain, but I know I will not be believed. It started with a letter I received from Dr. Winston Reed, the archaeologist. He is the top man in this field. You may have heard of the Yucatan discoveries and, of course, the Poseidon tablets found in the vault under the Sphinx. His letter introduced me to a Simon Kane, who flew in from Salt Lake City and made an appointment for the following afternoon.
Mr. Donner, I'm sorry that Dr. Reed has left again for the field. I should like to have him with me at this meeting.
Well, Mr. Kane, I don't quite understand why you've come to me. I'm merely a plant manager for Allied Electronics, and I have no interest in archaeology, nor have I access to any funds.
I'm not here on a begging expedition, Mr. Donner. I'll come right to the point. Do you know anything of the Poseidon tablets?
Well, I've read newspaper accounts.
The preliminary translations of the proto-lithic seals that surrounded the tablets indicate a civilization that flourished on the equatorial continent until it was destroyed by a natural catastrophe, identified as the biblical flood at about 10,000 B.C.
Oh, really? I'm afraid I had it confused with the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Oh, well, the lay public has not been informed that the tablets have been opened.
Opened?
Why, yes. The original inscription surrounded them. They were in wedge-shaped characters on baked clay. They had been removed from the tablets.
Well, it's all very interesting, but really,
Mr.
I think...
Mr. Donner, 14 tablets were never registered with the Egyptian Museum. They remain at large. Six of them have been translated so far. They indicate a scientifically advanced culture, and particularly, they concern themselves with a solar energy converter.
You mean that literally? A power source from the sun?
Yes. According to the preliminary translations, this solar converter delivers such fantastic power that it makes our nuclear source look as primitive as a windmill.
And I suppose that's why you've come to me.
Yes, we wanted to check the inscriptions against actual tests in the laboratory in a field.
Well, I'm quite willing to have my engineering staff look over the plans and give you an opinion if it will help you in your research.
Well, that seems quite fair. I'll bring them to your office in the morning.
I suppose I half believed him at the time. I had heard of the Poseidon tablets, and I knew that the frontier of archaeology had been pushed back far beyond current thought by them. You gentlemen of the board of directors will have to believe me that I suspected no fraud. I had no reason to doubt Kane. I called in Raoul and Henninger, two of our engineers, and left them alone with Kane. About 5 o'clock, I got Raoul back in my office.
Mr. Donner, it's remarkable. Quite remarkable. Of course, I don't quite understand the field mathematics involved.
Raoul, I want a simple answer from you because I'm a simple executive type. Will that thing work or not?
Well, of course, it'll need a field test, but theoretically, I see no reason why it shouldn't.
Well, should we build it?
Well, there isn't any question, is there? It's revolutionary. Quite revolutionary.
All right. You and Henninger are assigned to it. I'll give it a project name in the morning and allocate a research budget. You'll be working with Mr. Kane. I took great care to protect the corporation's interests. I shall submit in evidence the contracts I drew up with Mr. Kane. I set Raoul and Henninger up in an isolated shop in the west corner of the plant area, and they had a device functioning within 3 weeks. A week later, I checked in at the shop again and found Raoul still working with the power unit. Naturally, I asked what he was doing.
You see, I'm getting ready to mount the solar energy converter on the projectile now, Mr. Donner.
What projectile?
Oh, Mr. Kane leased a surplus one-man rocket from the White Sands project. We're going to rig the solar unit in it.
You mean power a rocket with the solar unit?
Well, it's in the translation of those tablets. You see, it's a question of field mathematics and the quantum...
Raoul, I'm an administrator, not a scientist. I ask you your engineering opinion. Is this a feasible research project?
Yes. Yes, it most certainly is. Using the solar converter, you could develop thrust up to escape velocity at only 10% of potential. This solar converter is creating more power than any atomic pile we have. Mr. Donner, this is it. Space flight.
Of course, whereas the purchase of the projectile was not authorized, I should like to point out to the board that I acted most conservatively. I checked the cost sheets and discovered that the rocket purchase was actually within the allowable debt limitations for my department, and so I okayed the project. However, I was concerned with the irregularity of an expenditure before authorization. So I drove out to Simon Kane's place to speak to him about it.
Oh, Mr. Dunner, I'd like you to meet Porter Hayes.
Hi, how do you do? Look here, Mr.
Hayes has agreed to fly the ship.
Look, that's what I want to talk to you
about. He's with the Pan-Columbian Project, and he's flown all the other types that have been flown so far.
This is the one that'll make history, Mr. Dunner. This ship will fly anywhere in the solar system, probably clear out to most other planets without even carrying a fuel supply. Best thing about it is the actual guarantee of a return trip. You know, those geniuses down at Pan-Columbia have plenty of ideas for getting you out there, but very few for getting you back.
I've been showing Mr. Hayes the photographs of the original tablets and translations. You see, Mr. Donner, aren't they beautiful work?
Kane, I want to talk to you in private. The cost sheets.
Hey, Kane, where's the last tablet? There are only pictures of 13 here.
That's right. The first 13 tablets take us through the construction of the unit and the ship and the inventor's 6 successful trial flights. The 14th hasn't been translated yet. It takes about a month to decipher each tablet.
You do it yourself?
Oh, no. That's a special study. My wife does it. She's an Egyptian scholar in her own right. Her father was Egypt's foremost antiquarian. I believe she's about to honor us with her... Nalja, I should like you to meet Mr. Hayes and Mr. Donner.
How do you do, gentlemen?
How do you do?
How do you do?
My dear, we thought you could give us a hint about the text of the 14th tablet. Are you far enough along?
No, I am sorry. I have only just started. The language symbols are a little different from the others. And it is a bit difficult to read.
Well, all I want to know is, when's the ship going to be ready?
In good time. It's waited 12,000 years. A week or two more won't matter.
During the next 2 weeks, I was too busy with other things to worry much about the project, but I would like to call the board's attention to the fact that I submitted multiple progress reports at 5-day intervals as required by plant operating procedure. I am at a loss to understand why those reports are now missing from the files. But one evening on a visit to Salt Lake, I was dining at the Pioneer Arms when I spotted Porter Hayes at the table across the room. He was with a young lady who looked familiar to me, even from the back, and of course, I realized it was Nalja Kane. I felt it was discretionary on my part not to inform Mr. Kane of his wife's continuing acquaintance with Porter Hayes. On July 19th, Kane telephoned and said the airship was rigged and ready to go. I had assigned him an area in our desert test base, and we scheduled the test for the next morning. I got to the test site a little late. Everything was ready, and they were waiting for me. The gantry train moved back, and without the usual roar of chemical rockets or the scream of jets, the ship rose gradually to about 10 feet, and then shot up to a couple of hundred, and then stopped again. Kane was on the intercom.
Hayes! Hayes! Is it powering right?
What does he say?
He's satisfied the craft works perfectly. He's going to take it straight out for 4 or 5 hours and then come back.
Well, he can't do that. There's too much he doesn't know about that ship. Tell him to come back.
Oh, let him alone. He's making history.
But the first time...
There he goes. Well, I think I'll go down the road a few miles to get some breakfast. I'll be back shortly.
That was 4 days ago. I want it clear to the members of the board that I have not notified the authorities. The ship carried the standard survival kit with 7 days' ration and water, and if he had no operational trouble, Hayes could stay out at least a week. Other than filing the original flight plan with the Joint Astronautics Board,
I had no other official obligation. When Cain did not return to the test site by noon, I went to look for him. Meeting with no success, I attempted to question Mrs. Cain at her hotel room.
I cannot tell you. I cannot tell you anything.
Mrs. Cain, this is a matter of vital necessity to our corporation. I have exceeded my research budget on my own responsibility. I must find your husband. If something happens to the rocket, there'll be an investigation. An official investigation.
It will all come out then, won't it?
What?
About my father.
Mrs. Cain, I don't understand. What has your father to do with this?
He stole the tablets. At least I thought he did.
You mean the tablets that you've been translating?
Yes, yes. I thought he had stolen them. Simon Cain told me that. He brought me the cases soon after we were married. I helped him smuggle them out of Egypt to protect my father. He swore if I didn't help him to translate the inscriptions, he'd expose my father and disgrace him. But now it's too late. He's dead.
You mean your father?
Yes, he is. Porter Hayes told me. He called me this morning.
That must have been before the test.
My father's been dead for 6 months. Murdered. Simon Cain murdered my father. He killed him and stole the tablets from him. Porter Hayes told me. He has the proof.
I'm really sorry, but if Mr. Cain did come into possession of those tablets illegally, there will be a great deal of litigation. Patent rights, you know. That's our primary concern. Now, of course, we'll have to have whatever proof we can. The original tablets, any photostats, notes.
They are all gone.
You mean Cain took them?
He destroyed them. He burned them. He laughed at me this morning. He told me I could never prove they'd ever existed.
However, we do have the corroborative evidence of the solar converter. It's planned at the plant, the prototype model, and, of course, the rocket.
Porter Hayes flew it, didn't he? He flew away.
Oh, Hayes, yes, but he's on the test flight. Now, as soon as he comes back, we'll have to get his affidavit. I'll admit I am at a loss to understand the absence from the plant files of all plans and prototype models of the solar converter. However, I am awaiting a report momentarily from our proving ground near Salt Lake on the return of Porter Hayes and the rocket. In the meantime, I am in receipt of a communication from Mrs. Cain, who had discovered a sketch of the 14th tablet, which remained unburned. She includes a translation, and I open this now in the presence of you gentlemen, and I include it in my report. I am convinced that the translation, which I have never seen before, will prove to you gentlemen my probity and my good faith in the corporation's behalf. And now I open the envelope. The translation, 14th tablet, and I quote, "The foregoing record is accurate, and we acknowledge a superlative contribution to science of the inventor." And there is a name here I cannot pronounce. I continue. "But we must admit his greatest contribution is in the proving of an axiom: where ultimate force is involved, it is better to know none of the laws than to know most of them. On the fourth day, the aircraft returned from far space to the point of its departure. The aircraft was in excellent condition, but the solar converter was completely fused into a shapeless mass of metal. Of the inventor, the pilot of the craft, nothing remained but his clothing and a handful of white dust. I must conclude my report by proffering my resignation. I will be at the district attorney's disposal when you gentlemen of the board choose to call me in."
X-1 has brought you Point of Departure, written by Vaughn Shelton and adapted for radio by Ernest Canoy. Featured in our cast were Dean Lyman Almquist as Mr. Donner, Ronald Dawson as Simon Kane, Jim Stevens as Raoul, Ivor Francis as Porter Hayes, and Ilya Bracca as Mrs. Kane. This is Fred Collins. X-1 was directed by George Voutsas and is an NBC Radio Network production.
We pause now for station identification.
X-1 from NBC from October 17th, 1957. You're listening to an hour of science fiction on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now an episode of Arch Obler's plays, rebranded Lights Out for a early 1960s release of a program that was first heard on November 18th, 1939 on the NBC Blue Network called Bathysphere. On most of Obler's programs, which he wrote, he was heard as host in some capacity, and in this next broadcast, you'll hear an older Obler setting up his story from about 25 years previous. It's Lights Out.
This is Arch Obler bringing you another in our series of stories of the unusual. And once again, we caution you, these Lights Out stories are definitely not for the timid soul. So we tell you calmly and very sincerely, if you frighten easily, turn off your radio now. November of 1939. Astronomically, that isn't even a blink in the eye of the universe, but it's a very long time measured in the length of our own very ephemeral lives. On that day, I aired our next story. Remember that date, 1939. A lot of heartbeats before we went to war against the madness of Adolf Hitler and his friend Benito. Listen to Bathysphere.
The sea is very quiet.
Yes, Your Excellency.
Will it be very quiet under the water?
No motion, Your Excellency.
I'm sure it'll all be very amusing.
I hope so, sir. The captain ought to have everything ready by now, sir. If you'll excuse me now, Your Excellency, I'll go see.
No, just a moment, Doctor.
Yes, Your Excellency?
You're much too impatient, my dear young friend. One of the great joys of an experience is to savor it before it happens. Yes, stay and talk to me.
As you say, Your Excellency.
How far under will we have to go to break the record?
Over half a mile.
How far's the bottom?
Just over the record mark.
Deeper than any man's ever gone. It'll all be very amusing. Suddenly the wind's changed.
Always at this hour of the day, Your Excellency. It's time to go.
I assure you that the sea will wait for us.
But I only thought that...
Don't think so much, my young friend. Thinking is an unnecessary pastime. The emotions are much more dependable. My thoughts tell me that this little excursion under the sea will be quite precarious. On the other hand, my emotions tell me that it will be most interesting and amusing.
Your Excellency, we are ready.
Oh, Captain, you too are impatient, huh?
I don't know what you mean. That is to say...
No, don't splutter. Now, come ahead, my young and impatient friend. We'll go aboard your diving bell and begin our little adventure. Come.
Attention! See, Your Excellency, we are quite ready.
Oh, Doctor, is everything to your satisfaction?
Did you put in an extra oxygen tank, Captain?
Yes, sir. Everything just as you said, Doctor.
The telephone communication been tested?
20 times.
Searchlight?
I assure you everything has been tested, Doctor.
The winch goes smoothly now?
Why, yes, I believe...
I don't want you to believe. I want you to know.
But I assure you...
Go and test it at once.
Yes, Doctor. At once, Doctor.
All right, men. Test number one.
Aye, aye, sir. Aye, aye. Test number one.
All right.
Well, your thoroughness is most commendable, Doctor.
We are going half a mile below the sea, sir. Nothing can be left to chance. The pressures down there are almost beyond imagination.
Yes, I know.
Particularly on this dive, everything must be perfection.
You mean the record?
I mean, Your Excellency, that your life is precious to the state.
Yes. The press of the world has known me only as a record breaker in the world of what they so quaintly term power politics. By nightfall, they'll herald me as a record breaker in the world of science, eh, Doctor?
If all goes well, Your Excellency.
If? You have doubts?
No one can predict the ways of the sea.
What are you talking about? We'll be quite apart from the sea inside of this steel ball, this bathysphere. Oxygen to breathe, telephones with which to communicate, lights with which to see. Why should there be any question?
Question of the human factor, Your Excellency.
You're as cautious as they said. I like that. I, too, am a cautious man. Oh, yes, indeed. My success has been based upon determining that the unpredictable cannot occur before I, shall I say, embark upon my bold adventure. I'm talking quite frankly with you, eh, Doctor? Well, please admit to do so. For a few hours, we'll be locked up in that steel ball. There's no reason you shouldn't know a little about your leader, is there?
You honor me, sir.
For example, I know beyond the shadow of a doubt the steel cable which will drop us down beneath the ocean has strength enough to hold 50 such steel spheres as the one we'll be in. I know, too, that you have made, let me think, you've made 30 such descents towards the floor of the ocean without the slightest misadventure. The men on this cruiser, they are specially trained for the work. And with my life in their hands, I'm sure they'll be particularly careful on this descent. Eh, Doctor?
There is no doubt of it, sir.
All ready now, sir.
Shall we go now, Your Excellency?
Yes, of course, of course.
Careful, Your Excellency. The deck is quite wet here.
Well, thank you, Captain. You're very thoughtful.
Thank you, sir.
Attention!
No formalities. Let the men go about their business so we can get started.
Yes, Your Excellency. At your work, men.
Would you like to get into the bathysphere first, Your Excellency?
No, after you. Quite a small doorway, isn't it? How fortunate we're both small, lean men, Doctor. Lean men. Caesar once said something about that sort, didn't he?
I don't know much about that sort of thing, sir.
Oh, I didn't imagine, sir. Get in, Doctor. I'll follow you.
Yes, sir.
Head first into the steel ball. Quite without dignity, eh, Captain?
Shall I help you, sir?
No, I'll make it all right. You ready for me, Doctor?
Come ahead, sir. And careful of the bolt end, sir.
Careful.
That does it.
You're all right, sir?
Yes, of course I am. Well, what are we waiting for?
Captain.
Aye, sir.
Close her up.
Aye, sir.
Your ears. Cover your ears, sir.
Huh?
The bolts and wing bolts that hold the door shut, they have to be tightened by hammering with a sledge. Cover your ears, sir. They've done.
But what an infernal din. Wasn't any other way.
Hammering is the only definite guarantee of a watertight seal, sir.
My ears.
All well in there, sir?
What's that?
A voice for the telephone, sir. They'll communicate with us from the deck every 3 minutes. If one of us doesn't answer within half a minute, the orders are to pull us up.
An excellent safety precaution. Yes, indeed.
All well in there, Doctor?
All well.
We're moving.
Yes. Lifting us out to the end of the boom, and then down we go. Look, sir, you can see the deck down there through the windows.
Glass and clear.
Clearest in the world. Quartz glass to stand the pressure.
Letting us down in the water, aren't they?
Yes, sir, in a moment.
We're under.
Yes, I'll turn the oxygen higher.
Light. So green.
Yes. Soon it'll be blue. Then a darker blue until at around 2,000 feet we'll be in a darkness that goes beyond dark. Complete eternal night.
Eternal night under the water. How amusing.
All well down there, sir?
All well.
How far down are we?
About 1,100 feet, sir.
And hard to believe it.
There is almost a quarter of a mile of water crushing down upon us.
The word crushing is most inappropriate at this time, my young friend.
My apologies, Your Excellency.
I've been watching the water. You said it would be as night. If it isn't black, it's blue. Strangest blue.
A few more hundred feet and there will be no more color in the water, sir.
The light out there. What?
I can't quite make it out, sir. Perhaps some sort of a luminous plankton.
That's amusing. The fish is carrying along their own electric plants.
The dark's alive with them, sir. Oh, look, sir.
What?
That small, flat fish. You see, even his teeth gleam with the luminous mucus. I've caught that sort in the trawls. They can eat organisms as large as they are. Wait, I'll turn on the searchlight and you'll see.
No, never mind. I didn't come under the sea out of any interest in those bits of fish.
As you say, sir.
They light up like a train in the dark. Oh, but the portholes of a boat be a more appropriate figure of speech. Well, seen one, seen them all.
All well down there, sir?
All well.
How far down now? Ask him.
How far?
1,350 feet.
Right.
You make good time, huh?
Yes, sir. They lowered us very quickly, sir.
A 6-foot ball containing a very earnest young man and the leader of the state. Headed for... What should we say, Doctor?
A new record, sir.
Is that as far as your imagination carries you?
At the moment, I cannot say, Your Excellency.
Well, perhaps when we reach the end of the cable, we'll discuss life and death very profoundly, eh, my friend? Philosophy under the sea. Yes.
Feet of cable, sir.
You were right. There's a darkness out there now that's darker than any night that man has ever seen. It's amusing.
We will have broken the record. You keep your eyes so close to that window. Might I ask why?
I thought I saw something out there.
What, sir?
Something huge. It gave off a pale green light and then was gone so quickly I'm not quite sure.
I'll turn on the switch.
No. No, this infernal darkness amuses me. Tell me, Doctor, in your other trips, have you seen anything out there? So vague, huge, you know what I mean.
Yes, sir. Several times.
Well?
Shadowy and indistinct. I couldn't say what, sir.
Can't you guess?
I have no answer.
All well down there, sir?
Oh, tell him yes, and stop annoying us.
All well, and
Captain's Grandfather... compliments, sir. You've reached 3,028 feet, sir.
That was Beebe's record.
Huh?
The old one.
3,030.
Broken it.
3,100.
Doctor, that's quite enough.
3,150.
Doctor, did you hear me? Broken the record and a few feet to spare. Order them to hold us out.
3,200.
Doctor, you out of your head? I gave you orders. Have them pull us up. I've had enough of this. I tell you that I...
happened. We just landed at the bottom of the sea, that's all.
Why did you ignore my orders? I said to go up. What are you doing now? What was that lever that you threw? Answer me.
Yes, I'll answer.
Haven't you forgotten something, Doctor?
What?
To say, sir, your excellency.
Excellency? Here at the bottom of the sea?
What? What's happened to you? All of a sudden, you... Ah, the excitement of creating a new record, a little too much for you, eh, my young friend? Well, it's understandable. Now signal the ship and have them draw us up. Your little adventure is over. Didn't you hear me? I said signal the ship.
How?
You out of your mind completely? Telephone them. At once, you hear me?
The telephone consists of a carbon transmitter, receiver, actuating battery, and connecting wire. We have no telephone.
Get to one side. Hello. Hello up there. Hello. Hello, answer me. Hello. Hello, blast you, answer me. Hello. But they don't...
The wire's torn loose. Would you know how to fix it, Your Excellency?
What? Oh, I see it. Happened when we bumped on the bottom, didn't it? Well, can't you fix it?
I can, but I won't, Your Excellency.
What is this?
It's taken you a great number of moments longer than I expected to ask that question. You notice that I've called you Your Excellency a couple of times, but that was the end of that. From now on, I will call you Your Infernal Excellency.
How amusing.
Still amusing.
Yes.
I don't believe it. You think it's some kind of madness on my part, but you'll do something about it.
Not I, you.
I?
You have an emergency way of signaling. Yes, I know you have. You flash the searchlight on and off 3 times, and the flow of current registers up on deck, and they know that it's an emergency. I'll go ahead and do it, and perhaps I'll forget your little... shall we call it... joke?
I am quite content to stay down here.
Turn on the searchlight. All right, I'll do it myself.
Why waste your time? You've so little of it left.
What do you mean by that?
The searchlight, too, is disconnected.
Why?
There's no need of it. It will be best to die in the dark.
Die?
Yes.
This is impossible. I investigated you, your record, your family, your associates. Clearest record in the state. You have no reason or the will to kill me. Kill me? It's really funny. A young, empty-headed fool killed me. It's very amusing.
You'll be afraid soon.
Is it possible that you've forgotten the final emergency signal, you fool? Yes, I said signal. The signal of silence. I'll try the telephone to schedule, and when we don't answer, they'll pull us up. Have you forgotten that?
It's been more than 3 minutes since the last signal. If what you say is true, why aren't we moving?
We are. For all I know, we are.
Are we?
The darkness, who can tell if there's an upward motion?
You know we're motionless. As quiet as in a tomb. Appropriate, then. And we'll stay here. I know that.
Huh?
That lever up on the roof that I pulled.
Well?
It threw the end of the steel cable free. Yes, severed the cord between ourselves and the ship and the world.
No.
We are here, Your Infernal Excellency. Down here to stay.
No. You lie. I don't believe you. They'll pull us up. The telephone here. Here, you up there. Listen. Get me up. Get me up. You up there. Hear me. It's your leader. Get me out of here. Get me out of here. You hear me? Get me out of here. Out of here.
Oxygen left for another hour, and it takes you 10 precious minutes of your precious life to believe. You do believe you're going to die now, don't you?
sure nothing could happen. Every detail of the machinery. The record of every member of the crew.
And I was one of those who was perfectly harmless, eh?
Yes, your past. Since a boy trained in the schools of the state. Your father, an official. Why do you do this to me? Why?
Your ego is so great that even now, knowing you're going to die here with me, you're less concerned with death than you are with knowing wherein you failed.
Answer me, why do you do this? You were trained in my schools, brought up to think the way you should think. Who up there made you do this thing and why?
It will be a slow death. As slow as the death of my country.
Answer me, who and why?
Your mouth will bite for air, and there won't be enough to let you live, and yet there'll be enough so that you won't quite die.
You'll tell me you will.
Your lungs will reach up through your mouth, a breath of air, just another. There won't be another. And as you die, you'll know it.
I want to know one thing. Why do you do this?
Why? Yes, I'll give you your whys. You trained me in your schools, and from morning to night, what went into my head was only what you decreed was right and proper for a good citizen of your infernal state to know. Yes. Cram my head full. But there's one place you and your books and your speeches couldn't reach. My heart.
Your heart?
Yes, heart. You heard me, heart. My head said believe. My heart said no. My head said obey. My heart said no. That's where you made your mistake, you devil. You didn't start in young enough with me. For the heart that was born inside of me has brought you here to die.
I don't understand.
Wait, I'll turn a little more oxygen on. That'll give me a little more strength to keep on telling you your whys and cut the breaths left for you after I'm finished. What was I saying? Yes, that you didn't condition me quite well enough. Should have started with the embryo, or somewhere along the line a little humanity got inside of me that cried out against what you were doing. It grew and grew until it said you had to die. And you will die. Yes, here in the black under the sea. And they won't roll drums for you, march for you. Ended here. What have you to say to that?
You fool.
Fool? Is that all you answer?
Yes, fool.
You think I'm a fool to die here with you? You call me a fool when I know that ending here, I give a new beginning to those up there.
Yes, such a fool.
Oh, stop saying that. They won't say it back in the cities when they know that they're free.
You fool? You think that freeing them of me will make them free?
Yes, of course it will.
I call you fool again. How do you think I became the head of the state? Through my great wisdom? I'm really not so wise. Through my great courage? No man has courage of that sort to stand up single-handed against the bullets and the bayonets of the entrenched powers. And how? How did I do it?
With lies and ruthlessness and cruelty, I know.
You don't know a thing. You saw the end result surrounded by pomp and circumstance, and you couldn't see the means. All right, I know I'm going to die. When a man is expected to die as long as I have, the actuality isn't quite as frightening as you might think. Since I am going to die, I'll have the one small satisfaction of showing you that you're an empty-headed fool.
Stop saying that!
You too have an ego. Apparently it's lived for weeks on how you'd make me plead and beg and squirm down on my knees. I had a few moments of hysteria, didn't I? You like that. But you don't like this. My sitting in the dark so calmly telling you that you're a fool.
I haven't failed. You're here.
You failed because if you're killing me and yourself to give them back their freedom, whatever that word means, you're dying quite in vain.
You're saying that because you think...
No, don't talk. Listen to me. I'll tell you where you failed. I came into power not alone through my own strength, but because the conditions of our country were such that other men sitting on their wealth came to the decision that I alone could keep them there.
But it was you...
I tell you, listen... When an ancient rule of privilege is threatened, it seeks to live no matter what the cost. The cost to them was me, and they found me worth it. For I threw to the mass none of the wealth they'd worked to build, but only fighting phrases of prejudice and hate that cost the men who made me nothing but the rent of the halls for the simple to hear my opiates. And so I call you fool. Fool to die and fool to kill me. The conditions that made me will still exist when I'm dead. You free them of me. But what of hunger? What of ruthless exploitation? These will still be free up there to put hate and desperation into men. And So the ones who gave me power will find a new leader to stop the Rumlings' rebellion with all the tricks that I taught them. A new leader. You hear me, fool? A new leader.
No, it isn't true. It can't be true.
It's so dark. If I could see your face, to see the fool discovering he's a fool.
They will be free. They will. They will.
What magic do you think will come into the air when I'm dead? Will men forget their greed and say, oh, we've quite enough? That's enough for everyone. Let each share according to his needs. No, fool. With me or without me, the game will be played just as it always has been played. So you're a fool and die like one.
Well, what could I have done? I had to do something.
I'll tell you what you could have done. You could have done the one thing that would have in time helped destroy not only me, but those who made me. You could have gone to the people.
What?
Yes, walked among them, worked among them. And at every chance whispered to them the things I kept from them. A noose would have been around your neck every time you opened up your mouth. And yet, in that talking of liberty and freedom and common decency and all the rest of that sort of thing, there'd have been far more meaning in this futile murdering of me. I've had them hunted down and shot, each of those who dare to whisper among the people. But as they died, I didn't call them fools, because I knew that they were wise. That only through the will to live and do of the great bludgeoning mass of their people was their hope of making that new world they wanted. Oh, why have I bothered talking? Yes, Faker. I'm tired. Hand me something heavy, fool.
Why?
Why? More explanations? All right, the last one. You think I'm going to sit here and wait and count my every breath until the dark's crawling with horrors and I'm No. I'll end it now, quickly. Yes, faster than a bullet shot. Give me something heavy, I tell you. I'll smash the glass. The water, tons of it, smashing in. I'll be dead, 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 faster than the thought, and that'll end it. Give me something to smash the glass, or I'll...
Yes, sir. Well, down there, sir.
Voice. Telephone. All well. Take us up. We're moving. There's water on the glass. We're moving. Doctor, the cable. I lied. But all this time, why? My orders to the crew were to leave us alone on the bottom as soon as the slackening of the wire showed them we'd hit the bottom. The telephone? I reconnected it while you talked. Then, you didn't really mean to kill me. Kill you? Yes, I meant to kill you. Had it all planned out. Tell you what I told you, and then you'd go quite crazy with fear. And after that, I'd kill you.
2,900 feet. All well down there, sir?
All well.
And yet you didn't.
The lights of the creatures out there. Blinking of stars on a cold night.
Why didn't you kill me? I want to know.
What would have been the good of it? A fool and a figurehead die together. No good of it.
So you believed me?
Even a fool can understand futility.
The water's getting lighter. Soon we'll be back. Up there. It'll be very strange at first.
I don't much care now, yet I'll ask. What happens to me?
You? I told you many things down there, didn't I? Yes, too many things. A man, in doubt as I was, talks too much. And since you of necessity heard what I said, when we get there, I will probably have you shot. The victim sentences his murderer. It will be most amusing.
Music. Lights Out, untuned to yesterday, a story first heard on radio on November 18th, 1939. And that wraps this hour of science fiction, untuned to yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's yesteryear. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark LeBonier. It's been a pleasure.